Tell us the words, Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm interviewing Vicky McGuire, who is the Joint Executive Creative Director of Grey London. And she has many fascinating anecdotes about the path she took from working on her parents' market store at 13 to running the creative department of one of London's most awarded advertising agencies. So there's lots of fascinating stuff there. But just to let you know that the thing I found most interesting was her ownership of a sweet shop. And I really could have spent the entire hour just chatting about that. But I did manage to restrain myself. And I think our discussion of licorice comfits versus licorice torpedoes is restricted to about 5 minutes. So I hope you appreciate that. Without further ado, here is my very enjoyable chat with Vicky McGuire. Okay, so hi, Vicky.
Hello.
Lovely to speak to you. So you are the executive creative director of Grey London. Is that an amazing situation? Is it really cool? Is it just kind of the way things have turned out and a natural progression? How do you feel about being in that place?
It's the best job ever. I mean, it's like I've been at Grey 8 years now and working really, really closely with like Nils and the team. And the journey that we've been on has just been like amazing. It's been ridiculous. It's been really hard, really tough. But with the right people and the right energy, it's amazing that you can take something that I didn't want to go to. I wasn't going to go to Grey originally. I'd left Wieden and Kennedy and I was skint. And a headhunter said, oh, there's 2 weeks' work at Grey. And I'm like, oh, really? And I rocked up there and I met the right people at the right time who all wanted to break a very big, old, lumbering agency model. And we got nothing to lose. And it was brilliant. There wasn't a client there that drew me. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go work on whatever it was, you know. It was just the right people pointing the right way on a bit of a mission. And 2 weeks turned into 3 months, turned into 6 months, turned into 8 years. So now I find myself kind of joint ECD. Nils is kind of like going off and setting up his own thing, which is going to be really interesting. It's always been when, not if. So he's got a bit of planning to do, but that's going to be great. And I've got the keys.
Nice.
Fucking terrifying. It's brilliant.
That's cool. Normally I'd go in chronological order, but since we've started with Grey, I think there's a lot of questions to ask about it. Cause I guess what you're sort of slightly obliquely referring to is the fact that Grey during, I don't know if you, it sounds like you started a similar time to me in the 90s, mid 90s, late 90s, something like that.
What, in advertising?
Yeah.
Yeah, my background's a bit weird though. I graduated from Newcastle Poly then with a fashion degree. I was a fashion designer for like the first 8 or 9 years of my life, but I was London's worst fashion designer. I got sacked from Vivienne Westwood, I got sacked from French Connection, I got sacked from Next, I got sacked from French Connection, I got sacked from Nicole Fari, I got sacked from Ted Baker. I mean, I was rubbish, but I really, 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 really wanted to do it. I was desperate to look for a home. And I was working at Ted Baker at the time, and they were sharing offices with a, do you remember an ad agency called HHCL? Do you remember Hal Henry?
Absolutely, yeah. They were the sort of stunt and experiential place before stunts and experiential were a thing.
They were absolutely brilliant. And we ended up weirdly sharing office space with them. So I'd see these guys. I'd see David Bonaguidi. I'd see, Naresh. I'd see Liz Whitston. I'd see all these people working in this really cool place. And I used to just go and hang out. And I used to be like, you get paid how much for sitting with your feet on the table, surrounded by really interesting books and toys. I want to do a bit of that. And so I jumped from Ted Baker before I got sacked and volunteered my services to basically anybody in advertising that would have me. And you wouldn't call it a placement. I had no book. I had no idea. I think if I had, I probably wouldn't have done what I did. Naivety and energy kind of propelled me. But people like David Bonaguidi introduced me to different people. I met people like Graham Fink, who introduced me to my first partner, who was Israeli and a brilliant book, but couldn't find a job because there is a latent, like, racism and, you know, and sexism in the industry. And we put our book together and we were the odd squad. And people saw us just out of a novelty. And eventually we got a job. And it just kind of took off from there, learning as you go.
So where did you get that first job then, as the odd couple?
First job, if I remember rightly, my first placement was at McCann's. My first proper job was at Butterfield Day DeVito Hockney, where I think I stayed for about 2 or 3 years. And working with very good people, you know, Rich and Andy, Paul Shearer, who were really, really generous. Looking back, they were so generous with their time and talent and just kind of like, you know, gave me briefs to work on, you know, gave me old D&AD and one show annuals to go away and look at. And then, and so, you know, looking back, you think, fuck, actually, you know, we haven't got the time for that now. So I've tried to see as many people as I humanly can because, you know, you've got to give a bit back.
Yeah, absolutely. So just going back a little bit further, I mean, having read up a little bit about you, you had your own, like, market store when you were 13 selling clothes and your parents did that kind of thing as well?
I'm from Leicester. My parents classic working class background. Leicester's brilliant. It's that one of the very first multicultural, multiracial cities. Nobody in my family is academic. You know, I didn't have a clue what advertising was until I'd literally started hanging out, you know, with HHCL. Very entrepreneurial, looking back. I mean, my mum and dad have got a store on Leicester Market and they sell secondhand and crap. And if you go back to my mum's house, you pick up a cup of tea and there's a price on the bottom of the cup because that cup is either going on the stall or she couldn't sell it and it's off the stall. And you go home every so often and the whole house has changed. And you're like, where's that picture? And it'd be like, oh, I sold it. You're like, where's that mirror? Oh, that was the gas bill. You know what I mean? Very, very, you know, you'd call it entrepreneurial, but actually it's very hand-to-mouth and very resourceful. And so when I was like 13 or 14, you know, it was called secondhand then, but it was vintage now. I used to get all my mates to go around jumble sales, buy old clothes, and I could sell them on to the traders. And then I used to put all my free periods together when I was at sixth form, which meant I could work out. I had Mondays off, so I could go and run a store on Leicester Market. And so when I decided to go to college and get a degree in fashion, it was quite a big deal. But I do remember my dad saying, you know, typical, the only bloody Maguire that's ever got a degree and it's in sewing. Do you know what I mean? So I really, really tried to make that work. That was my dream. And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because you think if you have a dream, eventually you will make it. You know what I mean? You will crack that dream. And it took me about 8 or 9 years to realise, actually, you know, that dream's wrong. That was not for you. And that's quite a big thing. And I think, you know, when you see these kids coming in, they're like, oh, yeah, now my dream is to work it here and I want to do this and I want to do that. And you really start to wonder whether or not you should just park your dream and just get on with it and see where life takes you.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's interesting because that beginning, selling clothes in the market, the vintage thing, I guess you had fashion there, but you also had selling stuff and kind of whatever the staff used. So it kind of was the root of both those two things in a way, but you weren't aware at the time, I guess, that advertising was starting to seep into you as a thing.
No, know. And it's really weird because when you look back at it, it's like I haven't got, you know, I'm a writer by trade purely because I can't draw. I was working with Paul Smith, and he was my mentor at college as well. And I could take all these designs to him, and it's like, Vicky, look, we just stop trying to draw. Just write your ideas down instead. And although I'd got no kind of like formal training in English, I haven't got an English degree, I haven't got it in A level, I think I've got grade one CSE, which used to count as an O level. You know, working on the market, coming from the background I had, there's you've got an ear, you know, for language and the way that people speak to each other. And a little bit of kind of like my lot are Irish, a little bit of, you know, the blag as well. And, you know, looking back, and you think actually, you know, they're not the kind of things that would pass a copy test, or they're not the kind of skills that would show up in a placement portfolio. But actually, you know, they've really done me well. So I'll always look out for the talent or the kid at the back of the class that used to make everybody laugh. You know, all those guys that are funnier than you in the pub, all those girls that can just kind of like cut anybody down with a withering one-liner. I'm looking for those when I'm looking for kind of like junior talent, as much as I am somebody with a perfect, you know, perfect folder and can code and all that shit.
Yeah, I found when I was looking at portfolios that the ads were cool. If the ads were fine, then that was good. But they needed to have another thing that showed they had some gumption. Like there was one team we took on who created a plate that you could heat in the oven and not burn your fingers. And they'd actually got it. They'd done the patent for it and they wanted to sell it to Meals on Wheels. And I was like, forget all your other stuff. That is the thing that's making me go, these people have self kind of... they're pushing themselves to do something and go beyond just eight ad campaigns. But going back to Paul Smith, do you think there's anything you learnt off him that you still use now that's beyond the fashion side of things that's in your current job that you learnt from him?
He was one of the most generous people I know, right? He, you know, he will tell his story. You know, he wanted to be a cyclist. He's from Nottingham. He had a very bad accident. Started hanging out with the kids at art school because he fancied one of the students who then turned out, what's fancied were the teachers, I think, who then turned out to be his wife. Totally entrepreneurial, started selling vintage ties, you know, hocked his house and kind of did all that kind of stuff just to kind of get his business up and running. And has always got an eye for mixing fashion, culture, always on the eye for a bargain, you know, and can turn something really innocuous into that little icon. I remember the story that he came across all of these Japanese snow globes of Britain, and they'd got the Canary Wharf Tower in front of St. Paul's, so the plastic had been put in the wrong way. And, you know, only he could buy whatever it was, a 5,000 of those, and turn them into kind of like desirable items when they were shit, really, and they should have been dumb. But that's stuck with me. And also, when I can, and this is a bit of positive discrimination, anybody with that kind of background, anybody who, you know, doesn't live in, I remember like years ago, everybody talking about we would have a young talent drain. And, you know, we'd lose people to Google and we'd lose people to Facebook and all this kind of shit. Over here, we're losing really cool talent to London rents, to the fact that, you know, you can't afford to live in London now. You have to pay your way through college and then sub yourself through two or more years on placements, nicking tea bags and toilet roll like I used to do. And, you know, and it's nigh on impossible. I genuinely don't think I could do it, you know, if I was a kid these days. And so, you know, I've tried to get around and see as many kids and students as I possibly can. And life gets in the way, doesn't it? And then you're like, oh, I'm doing it. And then you feel like it's such a heel. But, you know, I do desperately try to do it.
And do you dictate, like, Gray's placement policy and make sure people get paid properly and stuff like that? Or
we do, what's it? We're really good at stuff like that. It's like the whole the whole agency has kind of got that culture because of where we came from, that perpetual kind of underdog kind of thing, you know. It's and so anybody, we will always take a punt on people. You know, I think we pay them the London minimum wage, which is what we should do. We don't ask you what college you go to. We don't ask who your dad was. You know, it's a pure, we hire on energy and what we can see, not what we've read or what your references say and all that kind of stuff. So one of the guys in TV actually came to the agency 18 months before as a removal man when we were moving the offices around and was interested in what we did. And then suddenly 18 months later, he's in our TV department. He's a TV producer. Fucking brilliant.
That's great.
We've got suits that transfer over to creative. So we're quite fluid like that. We'll give anybody a go.
So it's funny that you go, the suits that transfer to creative. I've heard that happening from a few people. Have you ever heard of a creative wanting to become a suit?
Do you know what? I have toyed with the idea. It's that moving people out of the way to get you as close to the client or to get you as close to the problem as you can possibly get so you can help fixing it. I think some of us, and especially creatives, are natural fixers, actually.
Mm.
And I think the closer we can get to the business problem or the client, the better. And I've got absolutely no problem. I love going and presenting work. I love doing that. I know some people, you know, sit in offices and just shove it under the door and then it gets taken away by a bag carrying suit and then they come back a couple of days later, knock on the door and say they didn't buy it. I'm not like that. So I could quite imagine, if I was doing a startup, I would, you know, I think I'd try to do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Fucking terrible.
Okay, so go back to the advertising career side of things. So you're at Butterfield Day, DeVito Hockney, learning great things off Paul Shearer and Richard Nandy. What happens next?
Then I kind of just move up. This is going to sound really weird, and I really don't want it to make sound like some Jimmy Savile pedo ring. I was passed to different people.
That does sound like a pedo ring. It really does.
So bad. But you know, I was. Somebody introduced me to.
Gary Glitter.
John Merriman.
Oh, sorry, John Merriman.
So John Merriman, who used to teach me copy. I used to have to buy him a pint of Adnams and a whiskey chaser, and he would give me a brief. And then 3 days later, I used to have to buy him a pint of Adnams and a Jameson chaser, and he would mark the work that I'd done. And this went on for about 6 months. And God, I was such a better writer after that. And then he introduced me to, I think it was Dave Horry, who gave me all of his D&AD books. I think I've got from 1968 to mid to late 90s.
Wow.
And he just used to give me one a week, and I used to have to read it. And so you start writing and doing your scamps in black and white because the books are so old, and then you move into it. So it's just, there are those people out there, and I really hope we don't get too busy or too up our own arses not to see people like that and not to, you know, give them your time. I mean, when was the last time you saw a student book?
We kind of do it slightly differently over here. That's not to be...
Oh, you've changed. Oh, over here. Excuse me.
Well, ooh. We have a slightly different system. I can't really go into it because I'm not really supposed to talk about the agency, but we don't really do it in the way that it happens in the UK. That's all I can say. I'll leave it like that.
But, are you generous with your time and talent? Put it that way.
Yeah, but I feel like I'm currently, I know this is a bit of a cop-out, but I'm currently being generous with my time and talent because I also discovered, what I was going to ask about the Merriman thing is that I don't think craft is as prized or taught as much as it used to be in those days in the industry. And I feel like part of the reason I wanted to do these podcasts is because, I'll get into the craft side of things, you know, later and with other people as well. But I feel like there isn't as much of an opportunity for people to learn off like the great people in advertising anymore. So part of the reason I want to do these podcasts is to do that. And it takes a while to do each podcast. And I feel like hopefully I'm giving back to a lot of people.
Oh, I see. In that way. Yeah.
And also the blog. I've done like 10 years of the blog, and if you went through that, hopefully there'd be some tidbits there. So I'm copping out and going, let's go back to the
good answer.
Yeah, but the craft thing I think is a huge problem now, and I think it's become, it's sort of gradually dribbled away, because you know the primacy of the idea and the concept is fine, but I don't think there's enough people gagging to become a really good actual writer and a really good art director in the same way as perhaps they were in those days. And maybe people aren't divided in those ways, and maybe creative teams are just creative teams. Do you feel there's a lack of craft or a lack of promotion of craft these days?
I'm probably not the best one to talk to about that, because I am literally comma when you need a breath and full stop when you need a fag.
That's good.
So anybody, you know, am I a beautiful writer? No, I am not. Right? Can I communicate in a way that whatever audience I need to attract, whether or not it's saving somebody's life for the BHF or getting children to call 999, yes, I can, because I've got a good ear. I may not have a great pen, but I've got a good ear, right? And I think that is a craft. Now, have I met people that want to be brilliant writers? No, I haven't. Have I met kids that want to be creators? Yes, I can. Yes, I have, sorry. And I think their craft skills are get your message out the best you can by any means necessary. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's kind of like, you know, a writer that wants to show off their skill in that kind of, like, look at me, look at my beautiful long copy ad that nobody's going to read, because people may or may not read long copy now, although they do, when it's entertaining, engaging.
Yeah.
Bang your own drum, but the Tate stuff that's just come out of our place. You know, beautiful 48-sheet long copy ads, but literally, you know, designed on every level to grab your attention and keep you in. There's an art to that. So I think the traditional skills are moving with the times. We're just not recognizing them as such. If that makes, this is, it sounds really random, but, you know, I would go in and I would judge copy at DNAD, and the guys on the jury, and they usually are guys on the jury, will judge it by the length of copy. Rather, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, look at this, like buying it by the weight. It's, yeah, like sweets. Oh, look at that. There's about £4 a word there. Oh, look at that beautiful long copy out. And they won't be asked to read it. So why would anybody else? So I think there is a craft in looking at your medium, looking at your message, looking at your audience, and working out the quickest, most engaging way to get your message across. And that for me is a craft that goes beyond beautiful art direction and skillful wordplay.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the point of the ad is to communicate and to get those things across. And it's definitely not la-di-da, flowery copy. And I think people think advertising from the outside is puns, and possibly that kind of copy is what, and I think the older you get, the more you realize it's definitely not about creating these beautiful sentences that run onto each other, unless that's in the service of the communication itself.
That's exactly. You know, but it's weird. I was listening to Dave Dye's podcast you did, and talking about ad blockers and things like that. You know, some of those are beautifully written. Some of them are wonderfully art directed, but we're still turning them off.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a massive lump in the middle that is missing there, which is entertaining, understanding your audience, understanding that you're coming in, they can turn you off, so make them as engaging, as informative, as entertaining as possible, or give them a reason to keep watching you.
Yeah.
And that goes beyond for me, so that's, yeah, it's interesting.
Okay, so you've been buying John Merriman booze for a few years now, and Where have you got to? What year are we in and where have you got to?
God, we must be about 96, 97, maybe 98. I team up with a girl from Denmark called Dorte Nielsen, D-O-R-T-E, which mm-hmm. is kind of like Dorothy in Danish, who was absolutely brilliant. She was a great art director. The fact that English was her second language made me even sharper on my writing because I couldn't flower because it's like I don't understand it. So, you know, I think for about 2 or 3 years, a lot of the stuff in my book had no headline at all. We got the idea down to its simplest form. Dorte was great. You know, like, do you remember when you used to have to punt your book around and you used to try to get in to see people? And used to phone up their creative secretaries, and they were like gatekeepers. They'd never let you through.
Yes.
I used to get Dorte to phone up, and it'd be like, you know, you'd phone, somebody's secretary up, and they're like, hello, can I speak to such and such? And I'm like, yes, he's speaking. And she used to say, oh, it's Dorte. And you'd hear them put their hand over the phone go, shit, he's got a daughter. I didn't know that. You used to get straight through. It was brilliant. So we actually landed at Ogilvy under Patrick Collister, and we took a bit of a punt. He was going to offer us a placement, and we just said, oh, we don't do placements. And he was like, oh, okay, then I'll offer you a job. And that was great. Like, oh, well, so we're nice. Sitting in this office for a couple of weeks, and he comes in and he's got some brief, and it's for hair care or feminine hygiene, something like that. And we were like, oh, we don't do those kind of ads. we do beers and cars. And he was like, oh, okay, well, here's a Ford Fiesta brief. And we did some really cool work off that, I remember, just by thinking, oh, okay, well, let's give it a punt. So I was at Ogilvy for about 7 or 8 years, working with different people. The nice thing about being in a big agency is they let you take risks with your partners. So Dorte went back to Denmark. I got a guy in called Mark Chalmers, who was originally an architect, but Graham Fink had given me to him and said, there's a really interesting guy here, he's got no ads in his book. But I met him and he scared me. He'd got some really cool ideas, so I was like, come on in, and we worked together for a while. He's now, I think he's ECD Advice. And you just started working with all these really interesting people. And then I got a little bit itchy, and I couldn't work out where I wanted to go. And I remember picking up the phone one day, and it was a creative director of Mojo Sydney. And he was like, I've seen your work, I really like it. And I'm like, right, I'll be over. And I went to Sydney, and that was a massive mistake. I don't look good in a wetsuit. I don't like the great outdoors. I didn't laugh for 18 months. And I think it's well documented that, you know, my love of that side of the world, isn't great. But I had to do it. And weirdly, when I came back, I found a love of freelance and freelanced for a few years in some really cool places. And that kind of like built, you know, built my portfolio up, built my desk, did Amsterdam. And then I rocked up at Wyden for about 4.5 years, but still freelance. Still like month contract for 4.5 years.
And that was what, like the... So 2005 or 6?
We are about 2000, and I left there, I think. I left there and started my sweet shop, so that'd be 2008. So I left Wyden in 2008, did my sweet shop, and then went to Grey for 2 weeks in 2009. So, yeah, it's been 7 years.
So I know Tony pretty well, but what was it like working under Tony and Kim at Wyden's?
Again, do you know what? Tony, Kim, Matt and Ben,
yeah.
Big Stu, all of these guys were so generous and so open. And, you know, I've always said I've learnt more, and I learnt tons from them, but I've actually learnt more from the arseholes I've worked with rather than the inspirations. You know, I've sat, and I won't mention any names, but I've sat in meetings with some creative directors, and I'm just sitting there taking notes going, I would never talk to anybody like that. I would never do that. I would never say that. Why da-da-da-da-da? And you learn more and you learn quicker from those. And you know, Tony Kim were brilliant, and they were very, very inspirational, full of energy. You know, Ben and Matt are the most generous people. They'll just sit in a room and we'll just crack everything out. It's great. And, you know, and I've taken a couple of people over the years from Wyden to Grey because the energy is right and their attitude is right. And, you know, you very rarely get those people that come and say, oh, I only want to work on this. You know, they're like, brilliant, point me in the way of the opportunity and I'll give it a go.
I think it's fair to say at that time, Wyden was the hottest agency in the country, if not the world. And I think it's kind of interesting that maybe Ogilvy probably wasn't the fashionable place when you were there. I remember talking to a guy called Malcolm Gaskin at the time, and he said he'd been offered a chance. He said, I've been offered a chance to go and work at Ogilvy, but I don't think I can take it because I don't want to work in Belgium. Because if you worked in advertising in the late 90s, Ogilvy was the only place kind of outside the West End. And not only was it outside the West End, it was miles outside the West End. You had to go down to Canary Wharf. So Ogilvy, I know geographically unfancy, but also not necessarily the coolest place. And then Wyden's the absolute hottest place in the world. Was there a different vibe in terms of the way you approach things by being at either of those places?
Do you know what? No, there wasn't. The one good thing I will say about Ogilvy is that when you went to D&AD, you could always get to the toilets and you could always get your coat first because your table was right at the back, stuck out in the kind of, you know. But the weird thing is there was some, when I was at Ogilvy, there were some really good creatives there. And it's all down to opportunity and perception. So when I left, there was Matt Doman and Ian.
Great, nice.
Who else was there? Mark Fairbanks, who's just left of us. We had Belford and Roberts. There were some really good thinkers, but never had the opportunities that, let's say, you have at Wyden. My folder when I was at Ogilvy was the same folder that I got into Wyden and Kennedy on. The work was the same. I got a little bit more experience because I'd been abroad. I'd been over in Sydney. But the folder that I get on Wyden, it was the same. And when you get there, you approach the workers the same. It's just that the energy is different. The expectation is different. And there is a lot more open culture there. They don't care who, weirdly, you know, perception aside, they don't care who they get in. As long as they've got energy and they love ideas and they're open and they're collaborative and they can work in that open review system, you know, they feed the culture. They don't feed the ego. And I think that's one thing that I kind of like tried to, you know, bring with me. So yeah, that's good. It was good. I love them.
And also, I guess you've got a bit of an affinity with the East End because that's where you moved to when you moved down there. And Hoxton Square is very close to where Wyden's office is. I mean, it's a little walk. But, did you feel like you were more at home geographically there as well?
I did. I mean, I do. I came down to London in 88 and moved straight down to East. There was a lot of designers here, a lot of people that hadn't got any money. I used to live on Pitfield Street, just off Hoxton Square, purely because it was really, really cheap. And, you know, you were hanging out in the studio of Lee McQueen and people like that because none of us had any money. And people go, oh, God, I bet that was a really good time. And you're like, no, London with no money is brutal. It's shit. East is right for me, so I've been here quite a while now. And, God, I mean, it's brilliant when you walk to work. But I remember when Wyden moved in. They moved into a really nice old white warehouse that used to have really good raves and sample sales. And we were up in arms. We were like, oh, that's just great. There's an advertising agency moving in. It's going to ruin the vibe. And then Mother moved in around the corner. You're like, oh, that's just great. There's another advertising agency and they're going to ruin the vibe. And then suddenly a few years later, you turn up there and you're like, oh, this is great.
So you still live in the East End now? And,
Yeah.
So you must have seen it change a lot over those, say, 20, 25 years. And
yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I've changed a lot. I'm getting really old now. I walk around here and go, I remember when all this was fields. Do you know what I mean? It was kind of like, yeah, the area that I'm in now, we've been in this flat for about 16 years now, purely because it's so handy. East End's really handy for stuff. But yeah, the whole area's kind of grown up around us. And I'm getting very active, if you like, in the East End Preservation Society. Because I want to kind of, you know, I want to preserve all those kind of crack dens and kind of like dodgy haunts that I used to frequent in the 80s. And they were shit, but they were my shit. So I don't quite want a blue plaque there, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, Luna BBDO's office was on the other side of Commercial Street. And that to me, Commercial Street was a huge divide in terms of,
yeah.
On one side, it's Spitalfields, which was getting very she-she and bankers and people in suits. And then as soon as you crossed it, it was a much more grungy, even though it was now it was becoming upmarket, upscale grungy and expensive grungy. And there was definitely a different vibe on that side, which was cooler. But
it's funny, isn't it? Because I walk to work as well, even though we're on Hatton Garden. And I do remember stepping over some shit, and I was thinking, oh, that's human. Oh, the good old East End. I'm like, oh, my God. That's some kind of, like, bad estate agent. Oh, it's still as dirty, don't worry. Yeah, you'll still get mugged, it's okay. You'll still get a knife pulled on you.
So you mentioned your time at Wydens was coinciding with the sweet shop. Why and how did that come about?
Do you know what? I loved freelance, right? I worked in loads of little places. I've worked in big places. Blah, blah, blah. The one thing about freelance is you very rarely get the really cool briefs that you can put in your folder. I got that entrepreneurial itch again. And I was doing little things on the side, which I've always got some little thing on the go. And I was making jewellery for Paul Smith on the side, and I was doing little bits. But I really, really fancied a shop. And I knew that a shop wouldn't kind of like support me like advertising does. But there's a really cool road in the East End called Columbia Road.
Mm.
And every Sunday there's a flower market there. It's a Victorian flower market. And the shops along there only open at the weekends. They're like Victorian shops. And I was kind of thinking about those. And I was thinking, this is cool. Actually, if I get one of those, then I could work in advertising during the week. And then I could open the shop on the Sunday. And just as I was thinking about it, just as we were thinking about it, we were in the pub across the road from Commercial Road. I swear to God, it was fate. Some guy was hammering up a to let sign above one of the shops, and so I remember phoning the number on the hoarding about 11 o'clock one night, pissed, going, I want your shop, and I woke up the next morning, and I thought, God, we said we were going to open a sweet shop, because there's really good margin on sweets, and it still seemed like a good idea, so we just did it, and it's brilliant. There is something very, very addictive and very rewarding about serving somebody. Like, nothing goes into research. You can have your logo as big or as small as you want.
Yeah.
You can tell people to fuck off out of your shop, which is extremely rewarding. You can overcharge people you don't like. You can give stuff away to people that you do. And it was absolutely brilliant. And even though I might have been working ridiculous hours during the week, you know, the kind of hours that we have to do, you know, your coat will be on at 6:30, but you won't leave the agency until 2 in the morning because you're on a pitch or whatever. Side projects, and a project like that has its own energy. So it was literally like going away every Sunday because you turned into somebody totally different on a totally different vibe, and it was great. And so we've done that for 8 years now, and it's great.
Cool. So speaking as someone who basically lived and grew up on sweets, and not in a good way necessarily, I just have a couple of questions about sweet shops. Can you give me like a top five of the most popular sweets in general?
Rhubarb and custard, sherbet lemons, dib dabs, foam shrimps, candy bananas, licorice all sorts, midget gems, and licorice torpedoes.
So licorice torpedoes, rather than, and I sent you an email earlier on saying, I think licorice torpedoes are awful compared to licorice comfits. So licorice torpedoes sell more?
They do, because you get more in the bag.
Yeah, I just can't get my head around that, to be honest.
I know. I can't do pink shrimps. That's like eating packing foam to me.
Yeah, that whole list you just said are like none of my favourite sweets at all. And they're quite bland tasting. I don't think that the foamy bananas and shrimps taste very much. And the midget gems are the gummy sweets. I find them, they've got the least kind of flavour to them. And I quite like the new sour thing that seems to have been a development over the last 5 or 10 years. I'm into that.
We've got these sweets called Super Sours. And you're only allowed to sell half an ounce because they're like a very strong citric acid and they can actually burn you.
Wow.
And I give them to the kids I don't like. You get these random kids from Stoke Newington with ridiculous names like Phoenix or Maverick. And they come in and they've got preloaded Amex cards and they're like 7 or 8 years old. And they're like, oh my God, this is like the most fabulous kind of like sweet shop I've ever been in. Can I Instagram it? And you're like, oh God, I hate you. You're 8 and I hate you already. And they're like, what's your sourest sweet? And I'm like, oh, come here, little boy. Have I got something for you? And they're brilliant.
Okay.
We shouldn't have a sweet shop.
No, possibly not. I'm also going to say I like the fizzy cola bottles. That's one of my favourite.
They're a good seller, yeah, and fizzy cherry cola bottles.
Yeah, fizzy cherry, and the larger ones that you get as well, they're a bit more satisfying.
I don't do those. I don't do the super size. It's got to be small. They're too modern for me. Well, I do the, do you remember the old flying saucers? The ones they're really popular. The Americans take them home. And they think that they're bath bombs. I got an email from a woman from Venice Beach saying, hey, I tried those things in the bath and they took ages to kind of to disintegrate and they didn't really give a lather. And you're like, oh, sweet Jesus. Love, you're supposed to eat them.
Cool. Okay, well, moving slightly on from... I could actually talk to you a bit longer about that, but I'm not sure everyone wants to hear about my own specific sweet-based questions.
You're missing home, aren't you? That's what it is.
The very weird thing is, over here, just to give you a little bit of a... They have some really quite intense candy... They're called candy stores over here, but they will sell candy and sweets from around the UK, and they'll have the flying saucers and all the other things that you want. So if I need it, there are a few places I know where I can get.
Oh, you've got a fix. Oh, that's good.
Where I can get that kind of hit. So, but in America, they've got things like Butterfingers, which if you don't have them over here, they're like a peanut butter based crunchy bar. And to me, that's a bit kind of addictive and very bad for me. But. Okay, I'm going to stop talking about sweets. Okay, so you've done your sweet shop. You've done 4.5 years at Wydens, and then. Was it a call from Gray that got you to go over there?
Not at all. I was freelance at Wydens. My contract had finished and I was skint. And I think it was a headhunter that said there's a couple of weeks at Wydens, a couple of weeks at Gray. And I mean, I'll be honest. And I was like, oh, really? And they were like, look, it's only a couple of weeks. And so I rocked up there. And it was really interesting. I met a guy called David Patton, who was the, I think he was the chairman there, or the CCO there at the time. And he was an ex-client. He was an ex-Sony client. And he was a guy that had bought Sony Balls at Fallon and all these things. And he was like, we've got a really big job to do here. Not only do I feel the Grey is broken, I think the industry model is broken. I, as a client, used to get very, very frustrated by this agency model of three white guys coming and selling me an ad. I make a comment. They say, oh, no, we can't, until the creative director's seen it, taking a piece of paper back. He used to describe it as waiting for a pope, looking at the smoke coming from the top of the agency. And when you saw a white plume of smoke, you knew that an idea was ready. And then he'd have that presented back to him. And he was like, this has got a break. This is not only has the client should get closer to the work earlier as well, share the business problem, come in, talk to the teams that are working on the brief, but also, we're just making ads now for ourselves, and we should stop looking at, can and DNAD and start looking at what's playing in culture. Stop borrowing from culture and start to play a part. And, and all that's great. And so basically somebody's just turned around and given you this massive agency to go and do something with. And with the like-minded people, with the kind of, Nils Leonard, very young, very energetic, very hungry, traditional kind of design background, although had worked with some really cool people, and was a bit like a sponge, just took what these people had to offer, a bit like myself when I first started out. And he was pointing in the right direction. John Williams had come from BMB. He was a digital CD. So everybody was kind of pointing in the right direction, and we had nothing to lose. So that was so much fun, because when you go in as a perpetual underdog and you are very tight as a team because you spent so much time together, that breeds its own energy and success. And that was great. And we started getting really, really good. And then we were like, shit, we're going to have to hire some more people now. And so you start phoning around the names. You think, oh, we're going to need some good creatives. We're going to do. We're growing at a rate. And that was really interesting, because the names that you were phoning up and saying, do you want to come to Grey? And they were like, why would I come to Grey? What have you got to work on? What am I going to win an award on? And you're like, you're not. But it's a blank sheet of paper here. You can come in and you can influence this kind of like this rolling machine. It's really, really super, super exciting. And they're like, no. And then you phone up your mates at Wyden or at Mother and places like that. And they're like, well, actually, that sounds really interesting. That sounds really cool. I wouldn't mind a part of that. And so they were the kind of people, the Darren Wrights from Wyden, that we started to kind of attract. And they're very open and they're very generous. And so we have big reviews. We don't do the kind of like one team only review and all of that kind of stuff. And it's just started to kind of pay off, and the wins got bigger and more people came on board, and they were the right kind of people, and so the wins got bigger. And it was just one of these, it looks like an 8-year overnight success story, but it is and was and will be. It's very hard. We work long hours, but we're all in it together, and that's brilliant. There's no silos. I haven't got a business card. I haven't got an office. I only ever use a title, I suppose, when I'm going to go and see a client. I will work under a CD. So I will punt ideas into Darren Wright because, he needs a bit of help on a brief. I won't, nobody pulls rank. We've got a strict no arsehole policy, and it's paying off.
That's cool. My experience of Grey, I did 2 weeks there freelancing in 2008 or 2009 with my partner. And just to let you know, we worked on Purcell or something like that. And I think John Williams was there at the time. Maybe Nils was there. And it was a pretty grinding couple of weeks where we were told, you've got this, like, they have a formula. So P&G have this, like, the moment where you use the thing. Or I've forgotten what the acronyms were, but there was certainly a thing we were supposed to adhere to. And this lovely, quite elderly account lady came in and told us that we'd written everything wrong because where was the moment and this and whatever, and we were like, God, this really isn't for us. So was there a tension between, and I guess some of them are still there, so maybe a few of them, those kind of clients and their needs and ways of working and the kind of brave new world that you were creating?
I think that, they're always, for me, Grey came at a moment, not only in Grey's kind of in Grey's kind of time, but in a moment in culture. It's like P&G are starting to put, P&G are doing can talks. You've got the guys there saying we need to play our part in culture. They're giving briefs to the likes of Wyden and Kennedy now. They are turning a very large ship around, and they want more creative work that doesn't just broadcast their kind of like, you know, cleaner, whiter, better. They know they've got to engage. They've got to work out their tone of voice, their message. You know, why do they, you know, what makes them a company that should exist in this world? So the big organisations are looking at the brands and the work that they put out and are starting to kind of question it. So, of course, there's always going to be a tension, because even though the boss of P&G's and Unilever's are saying we want more creative work, we want to be, you know, loved in our homes and all this kind of stuff, that does take a while to kind of trickle down. So there is a tension, but we always over-deliver. So we will always take in what is expected, answer the brief, and then there's something else. Because one day, that something else will get bought. Okay. And you don't mind doing that as a creative. It's not just, oh, here it is, or I'm going to go and do another brief that's never going to get sold, because your ideas are out there. And when ideas are out there, they've got a better chance of being picked up by you or by anybody else that's seen them. And that's enough, because once they're out, they've made room for another idea. Yeah. Those believe that nature doesn't like a vacuum.
Absolutely.
They get your ideas out, and then something else comes in.
And so they are giving like Wyden's briefs, and they did a like We Support Mums thing for the Olympics or something like that, I think. So is there a method to who they give their briefs to and what they expect from each agency? Because I guess, you know, Grey is now quite fashionable and creative and cool along with Wyden. So how do they make their mind up about that?
Do you know what? I don't know. I mean, we have some P&G work. We don't have a lot. But we take it on a brief-by-brief basis, you know, which is if we get a Gillette brief or we get a Fairy brief, although I think that's just moved to publicist, we will have a look at it, work out what the brief is, work out what its merits are, and then have a look around the outside of that brief, which is, okay, is there anything that we can do with that brief where we can get Gillette or whatever it is closer to culture or to have a meaning and to have or find something entertaining in it, and we will just constantly over-deliver. So do we get the sexy Wyden briefs? I don't know, but we will certainly try to turn them into something, because we've got teams there that want to, that we've always said, you know, the dream is to do our best work for our biggest clients, you know, not to kind of like nibble around the edges of, you know, pro bono and all of that stuff, because those clients deserve the best work. So we'll always try to give them and then give them something extra.
I guess talking of the pro bono side of things, I think we're now coming up to the Angina monologues and the Vinnie Jones Heart Foundation stuff. How did that come about?
We'd had the British Heart Foundation for a while. They were they rank as one of my favourite clients. They're a charity client, but paid. They always came at, there was a woman there, Betty McBride, who was like, I'm going to pay you the going rate because I want you to take my account seriously. I don't want it to be an awards cash cow. I want you to deliver. I have KPIs. I need certain things delivered. So I'm going to pay you properly, and I expect to you put your best people on it. What a brilliant woman. What Great. A brilliant way to be. But charity, it's public service announcements, public service messaging, especially around health, have to be twice as loud, twice as entertaining, because not only are you telling, you're telling somebody something that they don't want to hear, and you're also getting, you're going to get lost in a load of messages from the Daily Mail that are telling you that goji berries are in and that Alzheimer's out, whatever it is. You know, there's so much noise around health and charity health. You know, and I remember them coming to us saying, oh, we've got a press ad we'd like to do to talk to women of a certain age and to tell them that, you know, that they are susceptible to breast cancer after the menopause, but they don't really listen because they're too busy looking after their own families to look after themselves. And you're like, seriously, there is no way that some woman who is ignoring any health signal is going to read a print ad like that. And weirdly, my mum had been going through it, had an operation at the time, And I remember going to visit her in Leicester General. And she got, there was about eight women. They were terrifying. When you walk into like a ward of women of a certain age, their humour is disgusting. And you're just kind of like, oh, Mom, I don't want to hear about that. And they just got this banter going, and it was hilarious. And I remember thinking, that's what we've got to do. We need to, we need these, you know, these women can laugh about the most bizarre things, the most intimate stuff, but they're doing it together and they're taking the piss out of each other. And like, if we can get a little bit of that, then, you know, we'll do it. So we pitched the Angina Monologues, and we got Victoria Wood out of retirement to do it. So that print ad turned into a stage play. I mean, we worked it out. It could actually self-fund. We could put the show on. We would have to pay for the kind of, you know, the rental of the place and all of the kind of setup. But then we sold the rights, the TV rights to Sky, who could have the program for 6 months, and then they gave it us back so we could do a DVD. And it was one of those things that just kind of like, we'd never had any experience in doing this before. But because we were up for anything, it kind of worked. And it all came together, and it was absolutely brilliant. And that was hilarious. It was filthy. Some of the stuff we can't even air. Terrifying women.
And I guess, just to bring up the C word, that that's kind of content in a way that people are striving for these days, especially a self-funding, self-perpetuating version of. So, and that's the one you won the Comedy Award for, yeah?
That's it, yeah.
And is that more satisfying than the Cannes and D&AD's things?
Totally. Although it's weird, I then did Vinny, teaching relation, hands over CPR. And much as I love my British Comedy Award, that ad saved, I think it's up to about 50 lives now. There are people walking about who are only walking about because somebody watched the ad that you made, took that message on, and then when somebody, a stranger, collapsed in front of them, they performed what you told them to do and sang the song that you introduced to them and saved somebody's life. That is so terrifying and humbling that that's incredible. And I've met 11 people that they refer to it as being vinnied. I've met 11 people that wouldn't be alive today if we hadn't done that ad, to the point where there was one guy who was a teacher, he was lovely. He had a heart attack in the middle of Waitrose. He woke up to find a Sikh gentleman pushing on his chest, singing Staying Alive. And he couldn't work out whether or not he was in heaven or hell. And that is, I mean, that's still, you know, four or five years, you know, that still blows my mind.
It's funny because the interview I just did was with Jeff LeBay, who's a creative turn director. Yeah. And he told me about the time he was at Wydens, and people were literally throwing their one-show pencils in the bin because they just did not give the first shit about any of it. And they're like, they keep sending us these things. What are they? Do you want them? And Jeff was like, what are they? And he was like, well, they're these awards. And he's like, I don't know what the fuck they're for. So I think the perspective of, I think when you're younger, awards are much more of a big deal and important because you see that as a route to you getting a raise and getting promoted through the ranks, because it's the only sort of measurable thing we have. But I think you're right that when you do something like saving people's lives, it puts everything in a very different perspective, and obviously is hugely satisfying.
It is funny, isn't it? I mean, awards do attract talent to us. You know, people see what you've entered around the globe now and da 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 da, and I've sat on loads of juries. The only one that I really that I've got involved with is Creative Circle over here, purely because all of the money that is raised through membership and through entering goes into a education and a sponsorship program for people like me. Kids that couldn't afford to come to London or pay their rent or get on those courses, we are going to fund It started with 15, but we want to get it to more. We're going to fund 15 students, put them through college, part pay their rent, give them an Oyster card, buy them dinner 4 times a week, this kind of thing, just to keep them in and send them on their way. And that's the one that, it, you know, it's the smallest, one of the smallest awards, because it's only UK only.
Yeah.
But that's the one that I feel strongest about at the moment. Because, as I say, we're losing talent, not to kind of Facebook or, you know, to coding. We're losing it to ridiculous rents and silly course fees.
Absolutely. So we're coming up to the hour kind of thing, but there was one thing I wanted to ask you, because I've written about it in my blog a fair bit, but Life Paint.
I knew you would bring that up.
Well, I think it's more Niels's thing than yours. I mean, and I completely see that there are different.
I'm so proud of Life Paint.
Okay.
So... I'm so proud of that. So we sold 200,000 cans have been sold through dealerships and Halfords now.
Okay. Well, I think when I wrote about it, that hadn't happened, and I think it was like a few cans had gone from like a couple of bike shops or something, and I wrote what I wrote in that perspective. And also I do see the argument that you're promoting a thing and it went all over the internet, so where's the downside of that? But equally, I think from my point of view at the time, it looked like it was more of an award creation or something situation to me. Maybe that was me being cynical, and I should apologize for that.
That's outrageous. Don't apologize. People need spikes, and this industry needs watching. This industry certainly needs some kind of moral watchdog, and I love all that. So you, honestly, you, when you see it, you call it out.
Okay.
In the same way as, you know, Cindy called out, what's his name from Saatchi?
Kevin Roberts.
Seriously, we do need to self-police. But no, Life Paint's cool.
Okay.
We've got more up our sleeve. We'll run them by you before we launch.
Please do, and then you'll know whether you should launch them or not after my moral arbitration ceremony has happened.
I've got a really strong shit detector. You know, I was sitting can juries. And I sit at DNAD and you're looking at something and you're like, really? Are you serious? And then you try to find it. You know, you try to find it on the internet and you're like, dude, the only place this is trending is on bullshit.com.
There should be a site called bullshit.com which has all the ads.
It should be an agency. Let's do it.
Cool. Okay, well... My battery on my Mac, pathetically, has gone down to 5%, and I'm really scared I'm going to lose this whole thing. So, and we have come up to a kind of the present day and had a really good chat, and I've really enjoyed speaking to you.
Make any sense at all?
Huh? Loads. Well, you'll see when I edit out all the ums, ahs, and you knows, which is what I spend most of my time doing when I go through, and not yours, I mean everybody's.
Be editing out the fuck cunts and whatever.
Oh no, say fuck as much, and cunt, say it whenever you like. That's great. So thanks enormously, it's been a great chat, and I'll put it up in a couple of weeks, because I've got I'm now sort of stacking them a little bit, just in case I go on holiday or die, my legacy will be a bunch of podcasts.
Oh, that's not a bad legacy to have, I've got to say.
Absolutely. Well, I hope people can learn a bunch of stuff from all of them, and including yours. There's plenty, I think, to take out of that. And so, huge thanks, Vicky.
All right, darling. No worries. Okay. I'll go back to Strictly Come Dancing now.
Okay. Cheers.
See you later. Bye-bye. Cheers.
Bye. Bye.
Podcast to watch Christmas.